Hello, my name is Nicole Harkin, and I'm here to give a reading from my book, Tilting, a Memoir. It chronicles my childhood growing up in Montana with parents who worked in the airline industry. And I'm just going to read a chapter that starts in 1996. 1996, Montana. Montana is home to one of the few triple divides in the world. If rain falls on Triple Divide Peak, a mountain in Glacier National Park, the water has the opportunity to flow in three directions: to the Atlantic, the Pacific, or the Arctic. I always wondered how the direction of the water would go in was determined. If it falls directly on the tippy top, which way would it flow? Would it split into three drops, each going in a different direction? Or the angle of the next drop falling on the first drop decide? How did the pressure from this next drop determine where the water would flow? We wanted Dad to live, so the pressure of waiting for him to die would end. The pressure lay on top of us, almost suffocating us. Every time the phone rang, I expected someone to tell me that he was dead. Every improvement was met with a setback. No doctor was willing to tell us he would make it, but they were quick to give us the worst case scenario. If he does live, he won't have any quality of life. We were there on top of the Triple Divide for quite some time. In one direction lay Dad dead. In a second direction, he improved and life went back to normal. In the third direction, Dad survived, but things changed nonetheless. We contemplated the first two options, not even understanding that a third way existed. The feeling of absolute knowledge is the same between religious zealots and doctors. They believe they know the answers to life's most vexing questions, but they don't, not really. No one can know, even with medicine's most advanced techniques or the prayers of the most faithful. No one knows who will live and who will die. Even as I hated this absolutism, I asked the doctors over and over, like the oracles of history, to tell me, to give me some sign that he would live. Dad's improvement happened slowly from that day the nurse told us his liver numbers had improved. Each day he improved a bit more, and the next day and the next. He awoke and moved from ICU to the step-down ICU. Then he moved to a regular hospital room. His muscles had atrophied, and he needed to relearn how to do everything: brush his teeth, put on his shirt and pants, tie his shoelaces, feed himself, cut his food, hold a coffee mug to drink his coffee, sit up in bed, turn himself to the edge of the bed, stand up, hold a book, move a mouse, put on his watch, take off his clothes to shower, wash his hair, dry himself off, walk. Neither driving a car nor flying a plane were mentioned. He hadn't died. He wasn't a vegetable, but he was like an infant who could talk. We knew when we knew, but the reality of what was happening didn't clobber us over the head in the same way his initial illness had. His improvements were gradual, and as was our understanding that he wasn't the same person. The process gained momentum steadily as a different drug, bandage, or medical device was removed, but he was still on a fair amount of pain medicine. He watched the Weather Channel constantly in his hospital room. "Montana, move the fan, please. It's going to melt," said Dad from his hospital bed. "What are you talking about, Dad?" asked 10-year-old, but almost 6-foot-tall Montana. "Montana, the fan. Move it away from the window." "But it can bring in the cool air. Aren't you hot?" "Montana, the fan's made out of chocolate. You can see that. If it stays in the sun, it will melt." We looked at the fan and then at Dad. Everything and nothing had changed. His healing process took months. Once he was awake, he could make his own medical decisions. Linda wasn't going to visit him often. His girlfriend couldn't be kept from him. I never saw her, but I knew she visited sometimes. The room would have the scent of incense or medicinal herbs. We walked a delicate balance in our conversations. At some points, being radically honest, while I had to clip his toenails or help him go to the bathroom, seeing him partially naked. But he didn't discuss the girlfriend. Discussion would have made his girlfriend real. I wasn't ready to confront that. I was mad at him about the girlfriend and about lying to me. But he had almost died and could still easily die. I didn't want our relationship to be strained. Once everything was back to normal, then we could confront this. I went to Missoula as often as I could, but helping him wasn't easy. "Muppet, can you scratch my back?" "Sure, where?" First, you have to pull me forward. Can you put some lotion on my back? I know. Yes, give me a second. Do I have any water? Here you go. No ice? I'll get some. How about some apple juice? Can you have apple juice? Nicole, give me the damn apple juice. Dad couldn't see our plight. He couldn't see how almost losing him had affected us. His trauma was his alone, which was normal if difficult to handle. Dad, you're acting like a jerk. I'm going shopping. I hope that when you get back, you'll have adjusted your attitude. I don't have to be here. And that's what I did. I walked downtown to the department store with the sun on my back that sunny spring day in Missoula. This being Montana, there were a number of bars too. I bought some black Lancome eyeshadow, in no way appropriate for wearing in Montana, and fish-shaped earrings. I felt guilty for leaving him there, but I felt good that I asserted myself and let Dad know he couldn't walk all over me. Or maybe I merely asserted myself to myself. I didn't have to allow Dad to manipulate me. I was an adult, and I was there of my own free will. The strange part of sitting by someone's bedside who is in a coma is that when they wake up, they don't remember you were there the whole time they were in the coma. He didn't remember how long I had held his limp hand, how often I had run out to the nurse's station to help him, or how I had cared for him. He was asleep, and then he was awake. I was there for him because I loved him. The fact that he didn't appreciate my love and my efforts hurt my feelings. Months earlier, and a few days after the trip to Missoula, where we were to say our final goodbyes to Dad, Linda and I stood in her bathroom. It was decorated in browns and tans, showing signs of age, but still nice. When I wanted to chat with her, loitering in the bathroom was a good place to do so. She was brushing her teeth. She compulsively brushed because she was worried her teeth would fall out, and she was trying to keep the cigarette and coffee stains off of them. After brushing, she lit a cigarette. She was allowed to smoke in her bathroom, in the kitchen, and in her sewing area in the basement. Those were my little brother's rules. Mom, why are you still smoking? I asked, worried she might die too. Not now. You know it's bad for you. What if you die too? Then where would we be? After we get through this crisis, I promise I will quit. We have to get through this, though. I can't handle stopping right now. I believed her. I thought that after Dad recovered, she would quit smoking. I think she believed it too. We believed that if Dad recovered, we would change our lives and become our better selves. We needed to get through this crisis and everything would be okay. Sometimes at night, I slept in Linda's room with her. In front of their bed was a large screen TV before those things were ubiquitous. We took turns sleeping in her bed. Montana did it the most. He was still little then. Her big bed was cozy and with a fluffy down comforter. Lying there under the bedspread and blankets, I could hear her breathing. Although she slept propped up, she coughed throughout the night, but I was used to the noise. It was comforting. I knew she was still there. My family operated like six little planets, occasionally intersecting and interacting with one another. None of us took into consideration how our individual actions affected the others. However, while Dad withered away near death in the hospital, we had pulled it together as a family. The fighting had stopped. We had worked to get through it together. I worked at the fuel station. Erica worked at the movie theater. John had the job at the body shop repairing cars. Walt went back to work as a machinist, even though he had recently retired. Graham bought groceries. We had this sense that Dad would wake up and tell us where his money was, and then everyone would be paid back and life would just keep going on the same track. Linda told her close friends about the lack of money, and we lived in a small town, so once a few people knew, everyone knew. The community helped us too. A neighbor had paid for our heating oil tank when it ran out in February. This crisis stripped everything to its absolute essence. We were a family trying to survive a crisis of physical, financial, and emotional proportions. Figuring this out became our priority, all without Dad in the picture. Later, Dad moved from the hospital in Missoula to the rehab center in Kalispell. He rode in an ambulance the 120 miles back. He returned to where he began. The rehab center was on the other side of the local hospital in a new wing. Dad reluctantly shared a room with another patient. They tried to pair patients with similar maladies in rooms. There was a debate as to whether Dad should be put with another stroke victim, a heart operation patient, or with an infectious disease patient. Dad's first roommate was dying, and he did so quickly. Dad ended up with the heart patient. The room ringed a large activity room with tables and exercise equipment. The patients were expected to participate in activities such as bingo or board games. Dad didn't like organized activities. There were professional. Dad didn't like organized activities, be they professional sports or other useless games. The nurses told Dad he needed to leave his room and participate as part of his treatment. "Come on, Dad. It's good for you," I cajoled him. "I don't want to play with these sick people. It's depressing." Like a good inmate, he finally realized that to be released, he needed to play along. I visited him at the rehab center, and we went for walks along the hallways. I held his arms as he walked. "Aren't you mad at the doctor that the doctor sent you home with antibiotics when he thought you had a viral infection?" "He made a mistake. That happens. And I did have a bacterial infection, just not the one the antibiotic worked for. But he should have checked you more or done something. He was negligent. Don't you want to sue him or something?" "I've looked at my medical records. People make mistakes, and suing them won't change what happened." I remain surprised he wasn't a lot angrier about what happened to him. He was right, however. Suing people didn't make things better.